Daniel and Revelation and where we are in history in terms of those books, one question which remains unanswered is, where does the United States fit into all of this? So today we're going to cover the United States and Britain in prophecy. And in order to understand the United States and Britain in prophecy, it's essential for us to keep in mind something. If you look at Genesis chapter 49, you'll understand what I'm saying here. Genesis chapter 49, beginning in verse 1, Jacob called his sons and said, "Gather together that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days." This is a prophecy about the last days. It is relevant to the world in which we live today. What it shows us is that there are 12 distinct tribes of Israel at the time of the end, and each one has a role to play, some minor, some a bigger role. The tribe of Joseph in particular has a bigger role. In verse 22 it says, "Joseph is a fruitful bough by a well. His branches run over the wall." Now, it mentions Joseph here in verse 22. That is the 11th son of Jacob, and the one to whom the birthright was given. However, look at chapter 49, and you see in chapter 49 that Joseph's two sons are mentioned separately, and they're each given a separate destiny. In Genesis chapter 48, where we see Jacob blessing his two grandsons. So let's have a look. Let's go back here. In verse 9 it says, "Joseph said to his father, 'These are my sons whom God has given me in this place.' And his father said, 'Please bring them to me and I will bless them.' Now the eyes of Israel were dim with age so that he could not see. Then Joseph brought them near him and he kissed them and embraced them. And Israel said to Joseph, 'I had not thought to see your face, but in fact God has also shown me your offspring.'" He thought for decades that Joseph was dead. "So Joseph brought them from beside his knees, and he bowed down with his face to the earth. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim with his right hand toward Israel's left hand, and Manasseh with his left hand toward Israel's right hand, and brought them near him." Notice how detailed this is. You know, the law of primogeniture applied that the eldest son was the one who received the birthright. That is still the custom in the monarchies, for example, of Europe. The eldest son. In England, for example, Prince Charles will be the next king. And then the one after him will be his eldest son, William. That's how the monarchy is passed on. That's how succession works. And in the aristocracy in England as well, if you have a duke, for example, after his death, his eldest son becomes duke. Unless the eldest son dies, and then it would be the second son. Girls only figure if all the boys die, and there's nobody else, okay? And that's the same with monarchy. Queen Elizabeth is queen because she had no brothers. She was the eldest daughter. And, you know, it was the same in ancient Israel. The eldest son was the one who received the birthright, received the bulk of the blessings. And so here, Joseph places Manasseh, who was the eldest son, right up against his father's right hand so that the main blessing would be given to Manasseh. "Then Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, guiding his hands knowingly." So he knew what he was doing. "For Manasseh was the firstborn. And he blessed Joseph and said, 'God, before whom my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, walked, the God who has fed me all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. Let my name be named upon them.'" So the name of Israel, Jacob, was to be named upon them because they were to be the ones who would receive the birthright, which was given to Abraham, and it was passed down to Isaac and then to Jacob and then to Joseph and from Joseph to Ephraim and Manasseh. So Ephraim and Manasseh, the two sons of Joseph, were to effectively be Israel in the main. Now, there's still the other tribes of Israel, but, you know, the main blessing was to go to them. "Let my name be named upon them, and the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth." A blessing of great, numerous population here. "Now, when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him. So he took hold of his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, "Not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head." But his father refused and said, "I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. But truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations." So he blessed them that day, saying, "By you Israel will bless, saying, may God make you as Ephraim and as Manasseh." And thus he set Ephraim before Manasseh. Then Israel said to Joseph, "Behold, I am dying, but God will be with you and bring you back to the land of your fathers." And then it leads into the prophecy, the last words that Jacob spoke to his sons, where he goes into details about each son. Now you look in chapter 49 and you see in verse 22, it doesn't mention Ephraim and Manasseh. It mentions Joseph. So this prophecy about the end time looks at Ephraim and Manasseh as one. And that is a key to understanding where we are now in prophecy. The problem is that most people, certainly in the United States, just look at America as a single entity, as one nation, and fail to look at the history that led up to America being the preeminent nation in the world. And therefore, sometimes there is a failure to understand exactly where we are now in prophecy. It is essential to look also at the history of the other branch of Joseph. Ephraim was to become a great multitude of nations. Ephraim was the one to receive the firstborn blessing, even though Ephraim was the secondborn of Joseph's sons. And Ephraim was to be the greatest first. When you look at this map, you see what Ephraim was. Everything colored red there was the multitude of nations. And what is colored blue is the United States of America. But the red, the multitude of nations, was up to a third of the world's land surface just over 70 years ago when it reached its furthest extent. So we're not talking about a long period of time ago, all right? And the world was dominated by the British Empire for 150 or even 200 years. You know, nations rise gradually, and they have their ascendancy for a while. They peak and then they start to decline. So it's a little bit difficult to say it started on this date and it finished on this date. The British Empire really began with Jamestown in Virginia in 1607. That was the beginning. But its rise to greatness was not completely fulfilled until the French were defeated at the Battle of Waterloo in 1815. And then Britain's decline started roughly 100 years later with World War I, and the United States started to rise to preeminence. So, you know, you see these things gradually happening. But the British Empire here is the multitude of nations that was prophesied as a blessing to Joseph's son Ephraim. And Manasseh was the one that was going to become the greatest single nation. Now, I want to read to you a quote from a book by an American historian written in 1940. He was at the time America's preeminent historian, James Truslow Adams, and he died in 1948. He wrote a history of the British Empire. It was called The British Empire, 1784 to 1939. He wrote it in 1940, which was a very, very significant year. What was happening in 1940? Anybody like to tell me? Nathan, you were around then? Great answer. Britain stood alone at that time against Nazi Germany. You know, you had this revived beast power that was trying to take over the whole world, and Hitler had conquered the whole of Europe. He still had to go into Russia, but basically the whole of Europe was under Hitler. And here's this little island just trying to resist Hitler's attempt to take the island. And Britain almost fell in 1940. In fact, a lot of people, including Churchill himself, at one point in May of 1940, thought that Britain would fall to Hitler. And the whole history of the world would have been changed. You would not be here today if that had happened in 1940. I would not be here either. So Britain was fighting at that time. So It's interesting to see what James Truslow Adams says in this book. This is the final paragraph of the book. And remember, he's an American historian writing about the British Empire. And he says this. Here's my cell phone going. I'll just turn it off here. In this great crisis, we in America have a great stake. Different peoples may have different ideals of government. But for those who have been accustomed to freedom of person and of spirit, the possible overthrow of the British Empire would be a catastrophe scarcely thinkable. Not only would it leave a vacuum over a quarter of the globe, into which all the wild winds of anarchy, despotism, and spiritual oppression would rush, but the strongest bulwark outside ourselves for our own safety and freedom would have been destroyed. This is a very prophetic paragraph, because this describes the world in the decades since World War II. Because what's been happening in the last six decades is that the British Empire has fallen, and it has left an incredible vacuum around the world, into which, as Truslow Adams says, all the wild winds of anarchy, despotism, and spiritual oppression have rushed. And the United States has often been called upon to try to sort out some of the problems that have come along with that. And the problems are just getting worse and worse, because nothing has replaced the British Empire. So it's important that we look at the British Empire and understand exactly where it fits and how it was a blessing, because it was a prophesied blessing to Joseph's son, Ephraim, as the United States was to Manasseh. The Roman philosopher Cicero in the first century made the following statement: "Not to know what happened before you were born is to be a child all your life." The problem is that most people today do not know what happened before they were born, nor do they care. As a result of that, when people vote, they are voting in ignorance, and the result is that we've got many of the problems that we've got, because people don't look at the history. They don't see what came before them. So today let's have a look at what I call Joseph's Revolutionary Empire. And I borrow the title slightly from a book by somebody Calder, C-A-L-D-E-R. I've forgotten his first name. It might be Angus, it might be James, I've forgotten, but published in 1981, called Revolutionary Empire: The Rise of the English-Speaking Empires from the 15th century to the 1780s, is the title of the book. The English-speaking empire, which is all of this, including the United States, was revolutionary, because it was not one of those despotic, tyrannical, authoritarian Gentile empires that you see prophesied in the book of Daniel. It was very different in character, in nature. And you'll see that as we go through some of these scriptures. Go back to Genesis chapter 12. One thing we will not cover, because we don't have time, is the migration of the tribes from ancient Israel to the nations of Northwest Europe. That is all covered in our booklet, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. It's also covered in many other books that have been written on the subject over the years, and you can look at those yourselves and see what they say. But Genesis 12 here. "Now the Lord God had said to Abraham," or Abram, "get out of your country, from your kindred, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing." So Abraham's descendants were to be a blessing. "I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." Now here is a prophecy, a promise, which is dual. There was a spiritual fulfillment of this in Jesus Christ, through whom the whole world is blessed and everybody has the opportunity for salvation. But there was also to be a physical blessing through the physical descendants of Abraham. Chapter 17 of Genesis, in verse 4, where God says this: "As for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be a father of many nations. So out of Abraham were to come many nations. Now, as far as the world is concerned, only one nation comes out of Abraham, and that's Israel, which is the Jewish people in the Middle East. And it's only been there since 1948. You look at ancient Israel, and yes, there were the 12 tribes, but for much of the time they were being taken over by other powers. So, I don't think that's what this is referring to. You shall be a father of many nations, was the prophecy to Abraham. Chapter 22 and verse 17. In blessing I will bless you, and in multiplying I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heaven and as the sand which is on the seashore. And your descendants shall possess the gate of their enemies. He has a prophecy of possession, of strategic locations that would give Abraham's descendants preeminence, which is exactly what happened, because the British in particular, but the United States also, received many strategic assets around the world which gave us military preeminence, and that military preeminence has enabled us to remain free nations for a long period of time. Now, remember, I've used this expression before, that this is a period of time which is an aberration in history. And it is in many ways. Because for a brief period of time, the world is not dominated by one of these beast powers, by a resurrection of the Roman Empire. And we have greater religious freedom as a result of that. But also for a brief period of time, for the last couple of hundred years, the United States, and for slightly longer Britain, have been free of foreign powers and have had security which has enabled us to live at home quite comfortably. But that is not the case with most of the world. You look at the continent of Europe, for example, and almost every country in Europe has either been conquered by a foreign power within the last century, or has had a civil war, or has had a revolution, has had incredible instability. We have been so stable that our populations have become very complacent, to the extent that now less than half the people vote, and most people are just terribly apathetic when it comes to anything political, and people are not interested in the rest of the world because they don't realize how the rest of the world can impact us. Now, in some countries, they have to know what's happening in other nations because it's going to impact them directly. Even growing up in England, I have to say in the 1950s and 1960s, there was a popular expression that, if America gets sick, the British catch a cold. Britain is affected, in other words, by what happens in America. And so is the rest of Europe. Americans have been very blessed over the past couple of centuries. Look at Genesis 48 again. And verse 20, thus he set Ephraim before Manasseh. Ephraim became the greatest power first. The Pax Britannica, as it's called in history, was the multitude of nations which dominated the world for a century between 1815 and 1914. British power at that time was greater in relative terms than U.S. power has been since World War II. In relative terms. America has more military hardware because of technological advances. But in relative terms, British power was greater because the British would go into a country, they would take it over, they would stay and administer it, and they would bring peace to that nation. So the power was extensive, and the British were able to get their own way in many parts of the world for a long period of time. The British Empire also had more territory, more people. In fact, the British Empire at its height was 13.9 million square miles. The United States is 3.9 million square miles. So that gives you an idea as to the difference there. Now, in this time of political correctness, we have to ask, how was the multitude of nations a blessing to the world? We saw what James Truslow Adams said. He said that the fall of the British Empire would lead to anarchy, despotism, and spiritual oppression. He also said, different peoples may have different ideals of government, but for those who have been accustomed to freedom of person and spirit, the possible overthrow of the British Empire would be a catastrophe scarcely thinkable. So to outsiders in 1940, The British Empire was seen as a group of nations that were accustomed to freedom of person and of spirit. In fact, I have a travelogue made in 1946, which if I have time, I'll show you later on this week. It's an American travelogue looking at London after World War II, where all the buildings had been bombed. I used to play in bomb sites when I was a kid. These buildings had just been destroyed by the Luftwaffe during the Blitz and in the years after the Blitz. And it shows London, and it describes London at that time as the mother of parliaments, as I'm trying to remember the exact wording here. The mother of parliaments is one phrase that is used. The mother of free nations. It describes the British Empire as an association of free nations and also as an association of free peoples. Now today, with political correctness, you know, we look back and say all of this was wrong, that this colonial period, as it was called, was wrong. You know, that it oppressed people. And so you see how political correctness has turned everything upside down. So we have to try and look at things without some of these negative influences which have come into the world in the past 30 or 40 years. So I want to just go through seven blessings that came to the world through this system. And we're looking here primarily at the British Empire, but to a certain extent some of this applies to the United States as well. Political stability, I think, was the greatest blessing that came with the British Empire. Political stability, without which economic prosperity is impossible. One of the greatest threats to economic stability is political instability. Few nations have mastered the art of transitioning from one leader to another without upheaval. The British and American systems stand out in this regard, with the British having enjoyed the greatest length of time of peace, 1688 till the present. Britain has had no revolutions, no civil wars, no political instability for over 300 years. America, remember, only goes back to 1865 in this regard. So America has had 139 years of political stability, but Britain has had 316 years. This one point cannot be stressed enough, because most of the world does not have political stability. You look at France, for example. France had its revolution a few years after the American Revolution. The American Revolution led to a system of government which, apart from the Civil War, has been a stable and progressive system. You look at France in that 200-year period, the same 200-year period, has had five different republics. They've also had a couple of empires, you know, emperors in the middle of the republics, periods of foreign rule under, particularly, the Germans took a large part of France in World War II, and then there was Vichy France, which was a puppet French government. You've had periods of chaos in France. You know, France just doesn't seem able to get its act together as far as a political system goes. And even now, occasionally you read of fears of the collapse of the Fifth Republic, which is the one they've got right now. So France has been very unstable for the last 200 years. You look at other countries, you look at Germany, for example, or Russia, and look at their history over the past century, and there's been a great deal of instability and upheavals as well. You know, when you have these upheavals and this instability, it is impossible for people to prosper. If you look at all the major powers, not one has enjoyed the same degree of stability and longevity that the British system has. The crown was the unifying symbol of the multitude of nations. The present dynasty was in place in 1714. The present royal house goes back to 1714, almost 300 years. The British have a political system that evolved over centuries. The 17th century was the time of greatest change, which also, of course, benefited the United States, because America at that time was still ruled by England. The original colonies were still ruled by England. But in the 17th century, England had a civil war and also a revolution in 1688, which led to what they've got now, which is a very stable system. The way it works is Britain is very democratic. It is just as democratic as the United States is. In some ways, the British have greater freedom. In some ways, a bit less freedom. It just depends how you look at it. It checks, you know, swings and roundabouts, as they say. But I don't think you would feel any less free there than you do here. But the biggest difference, of course, is that Britain is a constitutional monarchy, whereas America is a republic. And the difference is this. The British have a very democratic system. The people vote for their representatives in Parliament, which is like Congress. And whichever party has most seats in Parliament then is asked, the Queen asks the leader of that party to be the Prime Minister. And the Prime Minister has greater power in the British political system than the President does in the United States. And one thing, one reason for the retention of the monarchy in Britain is because the monarch is above the Prime Minister. And this means that dictatorship becomes almost impossible. I'm not saying it couldn't happen. But you see, the English were ruled by kings for a long time, and they had a parliament, and there was often conflict between the parliament and the king. And in 1642, the two clashed, and there was a civil war. And at the end of the civil war, parliament had won, and the king had his head cut off in 1649, Charles I. And a republic was declared. The republic came under Oliver Cromwell, and Oliver Cromwell became a dictator. So the English had a fear of this happening again. So when Oliver Cromwell died, it was decided to bring back the son of the king whose head was cut off, make his son king, Parliament would do the ruling, but the king would make sure that you never had another Oliver Cromwell, a dictator. And the system has worked beautifully, not just for England. It's worked for Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and many other countries as well that still retain this political system. But that's basically the way that it works. Now, if you look at Genesis 48, you'll understand why America had to break away from England. Because the only thing that united the multitude of nations, every single country, was the crown. Now, there were other factors sometimes, military security, economic ties, for example. But Canada, for example, always did more trade with the U.S. So the only reason for Canada to remain in the British Empire was because the Canadians wanted to retain their loyalty to the crown, whereas Americans didn't. So, you know, the crown was the unifying symbol. The multitude of nations was united primarily by the crown. So America had to come out of that system and sever its tie with the crown in order to fulfill the prophecy of Manasseh becoming a great single nation. And that's what we see when we look at history. Now, the second blessing that came with this system was security. The various nations around the globe that constituted the empire enabled the Royal Navy to dock and replenish, giving it an edge over other smaller navies. The Royal Navy protected all the territories of the empire. Britain had the greatest navy in the world until after World War I. In fact, if any country tried to build a navy half the size of Britain's, once it got to half the size, the British would go in and sink their navy before they could get any bigger because they didn't want to be threatened by anybody else. Now, finally, after World War I, when the U.S. wanted a navy as big as Britain's, Britain did agree to let America have a navy as big as Britain's, but not bigger. Of course, today it's changed. After World War II, it changed. But Britain's supremacy was built on its naval power, primarily. Now, you go back to the Protestant Reformation, you see the origins of this. You look at England there, colored red, and you see the continent of Europe. Catholic Europe, Protestant England. The only way to secure the freedom of Protestant England was to make sure that England had the greatest navy in the world. And that way, England could fight off the attempt by any of the other continental powers to try to force England back into the Catholic fold. And it's because of this that England developed that great navy, okay? And also then later on, because of the development of the empire, Britain was cut off from trade with the continent because of this religious division. So the British had to look for alternative places when it came to trade, and that was where the establishment of colonies came in. Security then was another blessing, because all of these nations in this system had security as long as they were a part of the British Empire. Thirdly, freedom. Freedom was the third blessing In 1807, the British abolished the slave trade. In fact, go back a bit further, 1772, Great Britain itself abolished slavery within Britain. In 1807, the slave trade was abolished. Now, we have to understand, slavery was universally practiced. If you go back a few hundred years, when the first Europeans arrived in Africa, slavery was already practiced. When the Portuguese arrived in West Africa, the Portuguese did not know what slavery was. But the buying and selling of people was already going on in West Africa, because the different tribes, when they captured people from other tribes, would then sell them. In this age of PC, you know, we've forgotten some of these things. So when Britain abolished slavery, it was quite revolutionary, because other nations had not done so. And in 1772, a British court made the decision that it was unconstitutional for anybody in Britain to own somebody else. In 1807, the slave trade was abolished, so you could no longer buy and sell slaves throughout the British Empire, which of course meant that slaves then could stay together as families. And then in 1833, Britain abolished slavery completely throughout the empire. There was a four-year transition period, during which time slave owners were to prepare their slaves for their freedom and help them to understand how to handle money and how to farm by themselves, or those kind of things. What is interesting is that because of delays in communication, the actual freedom of the slaves 4 years later, plus a few months for communication back then, which took quite a bit of time, the freedom of the slaves coincided with Queen Victoria's ascendancy to the throne. Victoria became queen in 1837 at the age of 18, and she was queen for 64 years, which is the longest reign in British history. And Victoria was seen around the world as a liberator. There are more places named after Victoria in the world than anybody else. The next is Alexander, after Alexander the Great, because of Alexander the Great's conquest. But Victoria was seen as a liberator, and the British Empire was seen as a liberating force. And, you know, you had lots of different tribes in Africa that asked the British to come in and protect them from other nations that were still practicing slavery. I've got a quote here from a book called Pax Britannica by James Morris. The Douala chiefs of the Cameroons — Cameroon is a country in West Africa right on the bend, I've been there — the Douala chiefs of the Cameroons repeatedly asked the British to annex them, but the British either declined or took no notice at all. The point is here, there were so many territories wanting to be a part of the British Empire that the British sometimes would just ignore these requests because they couldn't handle them all. But this is the driving force of the empire at this time. The King of Basutoland wrote Queen Victoria. He said, "My country is your blanket and my people the lice upon it." You know, asking the British to rule his country. Now, he would still be king, but the country would be a part of the British Empire. I remember a comment made to me by a man called Stephen Chimasaro when I lived in Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe, and I was in Rhodesia at the end of the colonial period. And he told me that in 1947, when the king and queen visited Rhodesia, the first time that a reigning British monarch had been to Rhodesia, he said his father made all the family, all 10 children, get ready to go see the king and queen. Now, they lived, I think it was 4 or 5 days' journey from the city that the king and queen would be at. But he made them all get ready, dressed up in their Sunday best, as they said. And he wanted them all to meet what he called — this is what Stephen Chimasaro said — the great white chief who rules the world. This is 1947. Some of you were alive in 1947. And they walked for 4 days or 5 days to get to Bulawayo to see the king and queen. And he said he remembered his father carrying a goat on his shoulders to give as an offering to the king and queen. They perhaps would not have appreciated it, but that's what they were given. But this is the esteem in which they were held still at that time. And this concept of an association of free nations was still there, even after World War II, okay? It was all to change, and the British Empire was to collapse. And there were lessons here for the United States, and I will show you those as we go through this material today and in the next few days. Let's look at some other freedoms. Freedom of the press. The British have always had a very free press. If you go to England, every day you're there, you should try and buy a different newspaper. You will come to the same conclusion probably that I have done, and that is that England has the best and the worst newspapers in the English-speaking world. Unfortunately, most people read the worst. Roughly 90% of the population read the tabloids, which are really trashy papers. But it is a very lively, free press. And nobody is beyond criticism. I mean, they'll make fun of everybody, they'll attack everybody, including the Queen. There's no respect for anybody, basically, in the British press. And in fact, the British have no respect for anybody, basically. I have to say that. But most British people don't have a respect for any of their politicians. There is a respect for the Queen, but even so, people could still make fun of the Queen. You know, they don't consider that disrespectful. And then another freedom which came through this system was voting rights. Parliaments were established in every colony except Hong Kong, which the British took on a lease basis for 99 years. So therefore, it was only meant to be temporary. And Somaliland, which the British only had for a few years anyway. But every single other territory within the empire had a parliament. That's what enabled the 13 original colonies to break away from England, because they already had a parliament. Over 90% of the males, the white males, in the American colonies voted. You can check that in the Encyclopedia Britannica. It brings that out. So they already had a democratic system in colonial times. So all these freedoms came with this political system, and these freedoms had not been there before. A fourth blessing is law, an independent judiciary, which is not the case in most countries. In most countries, the law is subject to the government, to the king, the president, whoever, and you know, there is no system of law. And this is essential for prosperity. Let me give you a contrast with African countries, for example. Because the law is not independent of the government, then you have no rights, including no property rights. So if you work hard and you become wealthy and you have a nice house, you know, why would you try to keep all your wealth in the country when the government could take it at any time? Under the British and later the American system, the government cannot take your wealth. I mean, obviously we lose some in taxes. But if you have a dispute with the government, you can go to court, and people do win against the government. That is not the case in most countries. Governments can do what they want. So what happens in African countries, for example, is that people who have money will keep that money in foreign banks, which means that money then cannot be used to develop their own countries. The banks cannot lend money out to develop countries like Ghana, Nigeria, etc. Because the money, the wealth, is all kept in foreign bank accounts. And why is it that people put their money in British banks, for example? Britain is the biggest single financial market in the world. London is still the biggest financial market. It's 11 times bigger than New York, even now. New York has the world's biggest stock market. That's different. London has the biggest financial market. In other words, trading in currencies and also, you know, bank accounts. A lot of people have bank accounts from all over the world in London. Why do they put them in London? Because London has been politically the most stable capital in the world. So it's got this long history of stability. You put your money in a British bank, it'll stay there, and it'll still be worth something in a few years' time, whereas you put it in a bank in Ghana, for example, and it might not be worth anything. And apart from that, the government could take it tomorrow if they wanted to. We have an independent legal system. Sometimes it's a pain. I mean, a lot of our lawyers are a pain. In fact, most of our lawyers are a pain. I hope nobody's a lawyer here. But realize, too, that in the British system, everybody, including the king or queen, is subject to the law. Whereas in France, for example, President Chirac of France is above the law. He cannot be prosecuted. Right now, everybody knows he's guilty of financial improprieties, but they can't do anything until he's out of office. And he may die in office. The next freedom, Point number five, another freedom, freedom of religion. This is extremely important. I thought about this yesterday. There was a picture of Catholic missionary, there was a whole section on Catholic missionary activity. And there was a picture from India in 1887, I think it was, where the Catholic Church was quite effective in converting lots of people. And it just brought to mind the fact that Catholic countries did not allow Protestant missionaries, but the British allowed Catholic missionaries in the British Empire. And in 1890, when the Prince of Wales visited the Pope thanked the Prince of Wales for freedom given to Catholics throughout the empire. The Prince of Wales should have asked the Pope to give the same freedom in Catholic countries, but, you know, didn't work like that. Jews also thrived. In fact, Cecil Rhodes, who founded Rhodesia, in 1896, when he was in the city of Bulawayo, he was at the time Prime Minister of the Cape in South Africa, but he founded Rhodesia, and he went up to Rhodesia for a visit in 1896. And he was being shown around, I think it was Bulawayo, it might have been Salisbury, the capital, it's one of the two big cities. And he was being shown around by Dr. Jameson, who was a friend of his. And he asked Dr. Jameson, he said, "What's that building going up over there?" And Dr. Jameson said, "It's a synagogue." And Rhodes' reaction is interesting. He said, "Oh, good," he said, "if the Jews are coming here, then my country's got a great future." It was, ironically, Cromwell who gave the Jews complete freedom in England in 1653, during that brief period of dictatorship. But the Jews contributed greatly to British wealth through their banking ties, for example. And the Jews thrived, and they had freedom of religion throughout the British Empire. The British Empire was, until 1947, the world's greatest Muslim power, the world's greatest Hindu power, the world's greatest Christian power, and the world's greatest Jewish power. So, I think that helps us understand why we've had so much conflict since the empire ended, because all those groups now are divided and all hate each other. But at one time, they were all a part of the same empire. Under this category of freedom of religion, remember what I read to you from the book Wide as the Waters by Benson Bulbrick, published in 2001, another American historian, regarding the translation of the King James Version of the Bible. He wrote, "The first question ever asked of an inquisitor of a heretic was whether he knew any part of the Bible in his own tongue. It was asked in 1233 of a man who belonged to a dissident religious sect known as the Waldensians, which emphasized Bible study and lay preaching. And it would be asked again of thousands of others before the course of history would render its dark implications null and void." The power of the Inquisition was only broken by the rise of Britain as the greatest power. Next to the Bible itself, the English Bible was and is the most influential book ever published. It gave every literate person complete access to the sacred text, which helped to foster the spirit of inquiry through reading and reflection. These, in turn, accelerated the growth of commercial printing and the ever-widening circulation and production of books. Once the people were free to interpret the Word of God according to the light of their own understanding, they began to question the authority of their inherited institutions, both religious and secular, which led to reformation within the Church and to the rise of constitutional government in England and the end of the divine right of kings. You see, the Bible was very much a factor in these growing freedoms. Englishmen carried their Bibles with them everywhere as the rock and foundation of their lives. Overseas, beyond the shores of Albion, the Roman name for England, it fortified the spirit of the pioneers of New England, helped to shape the American psyche, and through its impact on thought and culture, eventually spread the world over as wide as the waters be. Remember that poem about John Wycliffe, the desire of his followers to take the Bible to the whole world? That was part of the drive to establish the British Empire and to bring religious freedom to peoples around the world that did not have freedom. And all kinds of churches were going to every one of these colonies to try to preach their interpretation of the gospel to the peoples of those countries. And you still have, even today, those countries colored red there, although they're independent nations today, most of them are still the freest countries in the world when it comes to religion, including Ghana in West Africa. Ghana has this rich tradition of freedom of religion going back to colonial times. But the countries around Ghana don't have it to the same extent. The sixth blessing was economic development. Genesis 49, verse 22 says, Joseph is a fruitful bough. I have two very good books on this called British Imperialism. I've forgotten who they're by. They're by two men. I'll try and get the titles for you. But it goes into all the incredible development that came with the empire. Not just for the countries that were in the empire, but even countries outside of the empire. The British, for example, developed Argentina, Brazil, and Chile. Also, China and the Ottoman Empire received vast amounts of investment. The railways in many countries around the world were built by the British and financed by the British. The Louisiana Purchase, even after America broke away from England, the Louisiana Purchase was financed by a British bank, Barings Bank. Jefferson borrowed from the British to buy, you know, what, about a third of this country's territory. So the British had just incredible wealth that was, invested for profit all over the world. The British still are the world's biggest investors outside of Britain itself, bigger than the United States. I think the United States is now number three in terms of owning assets in other countries. The British are number one. I think Holland is number two. Holland's also had quite a mercantile history. But the blessings are economic, also even in health and hygiene, which came with this system too. Then the seventh blessing is the multitude of nations defeated attempts at world conquest by successors of the beast power on a number of occasions. The British, for example, went to war against Catholic France seven times in 150 years, between 1660 and 1815. And the significance of that period is that France in 1660 was the greatest power in the world. And, the British had to keep on fighting France, and eventually France was weakened and the British replaced the French. And then, of course, you have the French and Indian Wars where, again, this is forgotten because, people, again, don't know their history too well or they're not interested, but in the French and Indian Wars in 1755 to 1763, when George Washington fought in the British military, the war then was over who was going to rule North America. Catholic France wanted to rule North America. And if the French had won, we would not have freedom of religion today. And we would all be speaking French. We might be eating better and healthier. That would be true. But I think we're all thankful that England won at that time. And then you had this Protestant domination of North America, and you had freedom of religion, you had the English language, and so on. Those are the seven blessings. And when it comes to the seventh one, of how the multitude of nations defeated attempts at world conquest by successors of the beast power, World War I and World War II are the most recent examples. World War II in particular. World War II was an imperial effort. When you look at the history of the British Empire, every single one of those countries in the empire entered the war at the same time as Britain. The United States waited 2 years and 3 months before entering the war. America got into the war after Pearl Harbor. But these nations of the empire were fighting immediately. The war started. And the war started on September 3rd, 1939. The Viceroy of India, who was the British governor of India, the most powerful man in the world at the time, that's what he was called, the Viceroy of India, because India was, the second most populous nation in the world. China was in chaos and nobody actually ruled it completely. So India was, the most populous country in terms of having just one government which ruled over the nation. And India had its own parliament. The Viceroy was the British appointed governor, and he determined foreign policy and security policy. And as soon as Britain announced its war, declared war on Germany, the Viceroy declared war on behalf of the Indians. All 320 million people, I think it was at the time, that immediately were at war with Nazi Germany. And the Indians contributed 2 million troops immediately. Those were volunteers. There was no conscription. 2 million troops. In fact, if you look at Britain's imperial history, the contribution of India is just unbelievable. About a third of Britain's military might at any time was Indian forces. And Indian troops were used in many of the empire's wars. And the Indians were very, very good soldiers. I mean, in the Boxer Rebellion, for example, in 1900, when the Boxers rebelled against the Chinese government, they seized Western embassies in Peking, or Beijing as it is now. And they held these embassies for 55 days, including the American embassy. And a number of countries, America, Britain, France, Germany, Japan, Russia, at least those six countries, all sent a coordinated force. They all sent their military forces to liberate the embassies from the control of these Boxers. And it's kind of interesting when you look at it, because the French delayed everything. See, nothing's changed. The Russians, when they arrived, had no supplies. Nothing's changed, you know. The British, I'm not sure whether they were the first there, but the Indian troops, the British sent Indian troops, and the Indian troops were the ones who actually liberated the embassies. History records the British did, because the Indians were a part of the British Empire. So in a sense, it was the British who did it, but the British were using Indian troops. The reason why it lasted as long as it did was because the French wouldn't allow the other countries to get there before them. So France had to, bring up the rear, but had to be right there in the rear so that they could say they helped liberate Peking. So it's kind of interesting when you look at it. Anyway, let's have a break for a few minutes, and then we'll get back to this and look more specifically at America for a while.